In this podcast, I'm going to cover resistors, which are a physical phenomena component, and resistance, which is a concept, and how you separate the component from the actual concept, and a little bit more to help you in teaching. This is Pitical Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Now, the backstory to this is I'm doing cardiac rehabilitation, and a part of it is training and improving your cognitive powers. So if you've been sick for a while, been under several anesthetics, you get knocked around, and cognitive stuff is not being able to successfully do a formula. It's being able to set yourself a task and see how you go. It's, I don't know quite how to explain it. So in this case, I'm trying to get several podcasts a day, and I've just said, gone for a walk, said, okay, well, now you're going to give a talk, a lesson on resistance, and I have the various things floating in my head. So what we're going to do here is we're going to do some of the conceptual levels up the top, because of the nature of my audience being teachers and scientists, and then we'll go into the student experience, which will link up back up to that conceptual level. So you can talk about conceptual student experience, and then you struggle to argue it. But then, of course, people who aren't strong on the conceptual stuff will be turned off. So it's you can't really win on your strategies through. So that's the strategy through. And of course, I've got my meta strategy of producing podcasts and developing the structure of that, such that I get the maximum out of it. So without further ado, let's get into the concept of what resistance is. Resistance is the property of a component called a resistor. And resistance, by definition, is the voltage divided by the current for that component. So the resistance of a component, could be a resistor or something else, is measured in units of ohms, and you measure it by putting a voltmeter between before and after the circuit, the component, and an ammeter to measure the current through the circuit. The voltage will be measured in volts, and volts has a internal units of coulomb per joule. That is, a coulomb is the unit of charge, capital C. Joule is the unit of energy. So what this tells you is, if there's 10 volts and I push a coulomb through that circuit, and it's 10 volts component, through that component, liberated somehow will be 10 joules. I will put in 10 joules, and at the end of it, I will not have that 10 joules. Now, 10 joules can go many different ways. It can go in heat, light, sound, some sort of mechanical energy. A bit more complex there, but the idea is that that's the measurement of electrical energy. So that's associated with that coulomb going through. Let's move on to current. Current is measured by an ammeter in series with your component. So you measure the current going in. If you're very lucky, you can actually probably detect the current actually inside your component. But we measure the current just immediately before or after and assume that that's the current inside the component. And indeed, you want to do that to ensure that the current isn't leaking out of the component. It does happen, say with the toasters and various other things. You don't want it leaking out. You don't want it leaking into something else. But the current is the number of coulombs per second, the number of units of charge of coulomb. So coulomb is some incredibly large number of electrons. I just can't remember it off the top of my head. I've got a few numbers and a few e to the minuses in my head, but a coulomb is a set number of charges, so billions and billions of electrons make up a coulomb of charge. That says the amount of charge passing through that device per second. Now, if something has a high resistance, V on I, and V is the joules, you can also think of it as the driving force across that resistor for coulombs per joules. It's the amount of force associated, or the amount of energy to push something across. So if you push it between two points and a lot of energy is released, you can sort of infer there's a lot of force between it. Now, I'm skirting off some more complex equations, like voltage equals electric field on Q. But skirting around that, if you have a lot of force and a little dribble of current, that is the a large number for the amount of effective force pushing it through, and I the amount of flow through, you know that's got a high resistance. It's got a high resistance in ohms. So V on I has a unit of ohms, but if we break it down to more fundamental units, the ohm is a coulomb, a joule per coulomb divided by a coulomb per second. So that's actually joule seconds per coulomb, coulomb squared. Now this is interesting because a joule second to someone who really someone who's got some experience will say a joule second, that's an action. And that action is something which you get out of sort of more, equationally physics, the Hamiltonians and Lagrangians. So the definition of an action is the integral of Lagrangian over path over time. So a Lagrangian has the answer of a Lagrangian integration is an action, just putting it through, and that's a joule second. The king of actions is Planck's constant. So whether the speed of light is c, but that's in meters per second, the Planck's constant, h, is in joule second. So joule seconds, which is an action per coulomb squared, corresponds to something that we come across called analogy of between circuits. You can have circuits and build a mechanical device which is behaves exactly the same. For capacitors, you have springs. For inductors, which are coils of wire, this is for advanced people, is masses. And for resistors, you have a damping effect. And it is really interesting that joule seconds per coulomb squared is equivalent to a damping component. It's a power dissipation component in a circuit, or a property of power dissipation per current. And if you go into joule seconds per coulomb squared, so resistance times I squared will give you joule per second if you just run it through. So there's all that sort of higher interest in there. Now the thing that resistance isn't a gradient. It isn't a differential property. It's not dV dI. So it's not something that you can plot and take 3 points and get a gradient associated with it. And say, well, that's the local resistance. And I only say this is because inevitably, way back when, a couple of years ago, when I last had any form of teacher training or enrichment, I was ushered into the highest grade school ever with the top teacher, and he began to explain this fantastic exercise where you teach graphing skills by a circuit, and what happens, lots of strange things. They put V on the vertical axis and I on the bottom axis, but they were varying V, so by definition you really, as an experimentalist, should put V, what you change, on the bottom axis, and I there. And we're going to do that. I'm not going to confuse it anymore. And the idea is that they plot and put it through the lines, etc., except that the resistance is not the gradient. The resistance is the actual point, the ratio. So in this case, if you get a very high I for a modest V, that's got a low resistance. So if the ratio or the angle of a point, is very great, the resistance is very low. It's that the ratio of energy. Now, to convert that to angles, you need tans and all that type of stuff. But it is really the ratio that you go in, and that's what we have to really experiment with first. So let's, without further ado, we have talked about a resistor, which is a component. Let's talk about different components. You've got the classical resistor that students will not recognize anymore. This is a wire with a small little dumbbell of ceramic with lines on it, the resistivity. That's the resistance of that resistor. Now that's sort of almost gone by. There's very few people that see that component nowadays. There's very few components that you'd buy one for. It's something really of the yesteryear, the cathode ray oscilloscope. These things which were popular in the 70s, hard to find by the 80s and gone by the 90s, but still been taught in 2000 towards 2020. It's sort of a pretty amazing thing. So resistors in circuits, in small circuits, can actually be tiny little specks which are put in. You can see it's planted in by a robot. Or resistors in silicon components are just very thin tracks of copper. I really don't know how they actually make resistors in digital components, or whether they want to make too much of it. I don't think they do. There's other resistors power resistors, but the other important thing is that you really want to point out that some other things have resistance, like globes, or as we have before, the glow and blow Hill's famous resistor. Now, this is a small piece of nichrome wire which you coil up, and it heats up and displays something called some property of resistivity. So let's go, before we go, so this is glow and blow. So you build this little resistor, and you can measure the current and the voltage, and you can blow through it or get something constantly blowing or cooling it. And you can set the resistance by setting the temperature, by the power dissipation, by unplugging all of this. And so this glow and blow tells you that resistance, a resistor will have a set resistance under certain conditions, but they can be anywhere where power is dissipated. There's a whole series of things like that, and the resistance is a function of time if it heats up, depending on what the component is. Down here is a concept of called resistivity. So resistivity is a component, is a property of a material. So if you give a material with, you combine the resistivity and geometry, gives you the resistance of a material. So if I have something which is got a very low resistivity, but I have a very small cross-sectional area and goes for a very long distance, that will have a reasonable resistance. And there's all these ways of just subtly pushing this in into people. So there is a situation previous where I had described a component made of nichrome wire, aluminium, a pivot, and so the heating of the nichrome wire, it gave you an thermal expansion, and moved this pivot cotton reel, or a pulley, so to speak, with a needle on it, that would monitor the heat temperature. Now, you can actually have two wires going down, and effectively change the resistance there. So you can either put the current down one wire or up and up the other nichrome wire, or down both nichrome wires and up the aluminium wire. You have the option of doing this and producing this, just subtly putting in what resistivity is. Another brilliant way of doing it is having conductive putty, which you can change the shape of. They can actually physically change the shape of a conductive paste or putty. Look, there are many, many ways of teaching receptivity. There's another thing where you have an iron bath of different shapes where you can actually change the resistivity here in a controlled way. So you've got three concepts all sitting each other: resistor, resistance of that component, and the resistance is made of the resistivity, the material properties, and the component. Now we have to really have some pretty plain talking here about resistivity of a material. So I'm moving across the conceptual landscape really quickly. You might be confused. Students would be ultra confused if they heard this podcast without doing experiments. But the idea is that after doing the experiments, this podcast will make brilliant sense to them. Resistivity, people talk about the Drude model. That's the only model I have ever seen in schools. The Drude model came out shortly after the discovery of the electron. The electrons are very small, and then the idea, well, the electrons are really small, the nuclei are pretty small, they would sit there, so it's the metal is mostly empty space, and with iron cores, so if you pick up a piece of empty metal, it's mostly empty, and indeed, a lot of teachers and scientists would say that most things I hold are empty space. I don't know how you do it. That's not supported by quantum mechanics, nor is the Drude model. The Drude model lasted 1901 to 1901. It lasted 1 year, but it went forward to be the basis of Bohr. Bohr picked it up, and it sort of had a second life. So it makes the Drude model seems natural because we teach the Bohr model of the atom. So it's like the Bohr model of the atom with the free electrons going through. And if those free electrons can actually stream past the nuclei without bumping into it, no energy is dissipated. But if you shake that Drude model around across, you will create a collision, inelastic collision, with the iron and the electron core, and it creates a crystal vibration which will cause heat. This model, I don't think anybody would... I think it's been used from time to time to explain certain things. The answer is a bit more complex, with Fermi surfaces, filling of band energy levels, and electron wave functions which go from one end of the crystal to another. In fact, depending on how you define it, right across the metal. So an electron is actually extended in size right across the metal. And this is a very amazing thing to see. If electrons are extended and you add electron upon electron upon electron, that looks silvery. In fact, when you're looking at a conductor and it is silvery and lustrous, you're actually looking at those extended electrons. Now, the problem is that if you have really taught people on the Drude model, telling them that, which is sort of an inspirational view, that you can actually see electrons, and electrons are diffuse like this, is a step in the right direction, but a step in the wrong direction in the short-term goal for getting them to go through an examination system which asks them about the Drude model. Different components. Really, it's not explained. The Drude model doesn't explain the conductivity of electrons, but the electrons and their ability to interact with the lattice, the actual electron orbitals, able to interact with lattice vibrations and convert electrical energy to heat, is really a property of the wave function of the higher electron. So you've got, I think it's copper, silver, gold on the, let's work it out, 2 plus 10 minus 1 is on the 11th group down. That's the, not on the noble, the equivalent of noble gases of the D block. The one block before will give you your conductive metals, and silver is the most conductive metals, and it's all to do with electronic wave functions. Obviously, you can't say that to students, but copper is highly conductive, various other things. There's a relationship between thermal conductivity and electrical conductivity, because the transport of heat is by electrons from the Fermi, Fermi surface, your Fermi sphere. So that's a very important aspect, the relationship. And of course, you get basically, as I said before, if you want to make a battery, you just stick a nail in a flame, and of course the electrons will rush away from the flame and create negative charge at the head of your nail. Now, this may be good, but you've got to actually create a circuit of it. So you stick in a nail and then stick in another material, and then you've got yourself a power source. Pretty astonishing, but this power source is this sticking two metals into a flame and getting the electrons to rush away differentially and picking up from the same cold junction. So you've got hot junction, cold junction, and you can tap off power, is how they power these remote spacecrafts. They don't have a little, you know, a diesel generator up there. They've got these plutonium, what's it, 238. I have to really, really think. Oh, no, it's plutonium 238, I think it is, going to my head. I really can't remember off the top of my head. Those heat sources on these metals produce that type of stuff. So to really understand that aspect, you really have to go the non-Drude model. So this is all the background information that you have to have in your head before you begin teaching electronics. So let's go with our first experience of where we measure the resistance of a Hill glow and blow resistor, and being able to set different voltage drops across it, you can produce a I versus V graph. That is, you change it to get a certain voltage and then you measure the current. So the thing which the dependent variable, which is current, always goes in the vertical axis. That's science convention, and that's the law. So you measure one of those components and measure how it relates to the resistance varies as you increase the voltage. And so there's no way that you can actually there's a fairly big snake going past here. Okay, there it is. Okay, sorry about that one. I'm out here in the Australian bush looking out over a big sort of canyon valley system. But getting back into it, you produce a IV characteristic. There's a VI characteristic. You'll have to really get it in there. Then you can actually immerse that component in water and do exactly the same thing, and you'll notice a different characteristic. And then you can actually get a small resistor. So this is to track the component of resistor, the heat production capacity, and then another component where you do the same thing and measure it across the R component. So what you're doing is, for a particular setting, the resistance is simply the voltage on the current going through that. But here we're saying that the normal thing is a non-ohmic resistor, and the exception is these components which we pay some money for, and they have the beautiful property of being an ohmic resistor. That is, V on I is constant for a fairly substantial range of resistance. Look, there's a few other things. So let's go through the resistance that they should measure. The resistance for a glow and blow in water, and the resistance of a commercial resistor, which is designed to provide a set resistance. And that's just one set of properties. Then the actual resistance for a variable geometry resistor, where you can, with the same material, extend it or compress it into different geometries. So the material's constant, but the geometry is different. And then again, for the same geometries, different materials. And again, going up, being able to measure different lengths, which is the same geometry, but different lengths going through. That's covered very much off the top of my head. Resistance and resistors and resistivity, that component there. And only after you have actually given students actual physical hands-on practical experience, do you introduce a broad series of problems. And the way I would suggest it is a series of repeated problems, and if they get the answer right, they can skip five or whatever. So I've got a series of problems that you give. So if a student's understanding their work, they can actually move through it more quickly and move through the series of concepts as taught. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Hill Explains. Keep on practicing science, thinking science, and teaching science.